Okay, everyone, thanks for making it on the call. I'm Josh Schlossberg with Energy Justice Network. This is this month's National Anti-Biomass Incineration Campaign call. We have calls on the first Thursday of every month at 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. That may be changing. We focus on a particular topic relevant to biomass energy every single month, and we invite guest speakers, and, of course, we discuss the issue. This month's topic is Court Rejects EPA Rule That Deferred Carbon Standards for Biomass Energy, the biomass industry, rather. For the next hour, we'll discuss the recent federal court ruling that's now forcing the EPA to make a decision on how they account for carbon dioxide emissions from biomass incinerators. Our excellent guest speaker, who we're very happy to have here, is Kevin Bundy. He's senior attorney for Center for Biological Diversity based in San Francisco. Center for Biological Diversity was one of the petitioners in the lawsuit against the EPA, and Mr. Bundy is going to discuss what this recent ruling means for the future of biomass incineration in the U.S. We're going to have Mr. Bundy speak for about 15 minutes, and then we'll have the remaining 45 minutes for questions, so please hold your questions until then. And again, we are recording this call not to mimic the NSA, but just to spread this information out to other folks. And Samantha Chirillo with Energy Justice Network will be taking notes, and we'll be sending those out as well if you want those. And we're just going to take it away, Mr. Bundy.
All right, Josh, thanks so much, and thanks to everyone for calling in. Just listening to the introductions, I hear the voices of a lot of really really terrific activists on this issue, and it's a pleasure and an honor to be talking with all of you about this case. And like Josh said, I'm gonna try to keep to about 15 minutes. I know that there's I'm a lawyer and have been deep in the Clean Air Act weeds on this case and a couple others for a couple years now. I don't have a ton of experience in the area, but enough to have amassed some detail. I know there's a range of experience folks on the call in terms of the law, so. What I'm going to do is try to back up a couple of steps and give some background and some context on the Clean Air Act and how it regulates greenhouse gas emissions, where biomass fits into all that, so that everybody can kind of understand what the ruling does and doesn't do, so you have a sense of the context. And I apologize to those of you who are familiar with a lot of this, but I feel like it's probably good to start with some background. This decision is a very big deal for biomass, especially biomass energy generation, but it also is just kind of a small part of the larger effort to regulate greenhouse gases under the Clean Air Act. The Clean Air Act is one of the nation's foremost environmental laws. It's been working for more than 40 years to reduce emissions of air pollutants and essentially force big industrial facilities to control the emissions that come out of the smokestack. So I'm going to give a little bit of a background on the law, where the decision fits in, what the decision says, and what its implications are for the biomass industry, as near as we can tell at this point. So the Clean Air Act covers all sources of air pollution. There are multiple programs under the Clean Air Act, different ways that the law applies. Generally, the Act divides sources of air pollution up into mobile sources like cars and trucks, planes and ships, and so-called stationary sources, things that stay put, like power plants and industrial facilities. Two of the Clean Air Act's big stationary source permitting programs are at issue in this case. The major one is the Prevention of Significant Deterioration Program, or the PSD program. I'll be using that acronym PSD, and it just refers to this program. The PSD program, in basic terms, requires these big industrial facilities to get a permit before they start construction. And as part of that permit, there are emissions limits, there are limits imposed, numeric limits imposed on the amount of pollution these sources can generate based on application of what's called the best available control technology. It's a term of art, essentially means what other people have managed to do in a cost-effective way at other similar facilities. And what it tends to do is impose, if not the best pollution control, at least some reasonable pollution control on these big facilities for all of the regulated pollutants that they emit. There's another permitting program involved, the Title V permitting program, which I think a lot of citizen activists engage with respect to particular facilities. Title V doesn't impose any requirements of its own, but it gathers other requirements, such as the emissions limits and a PSD permit, together in one federally enforceable place. So that's kind of the legal background. The history of this case actually goes back many, many years. There has been a long, years-long effort by environmental groups, progressive states, to get the EPA to start regulating greenhouse gases as air pollutants under the Clean Air Act. Folks are probably familiar with the Massachusetts versus EPA decision, the Supreme Court's decision in 2007 that affirmed that greenhouse gases are pollutants under the Clean Air Act and ordered EPA to decide whether they endanger public health and welfare. That finding, that so-called endangerment finding, is a prerequisite for regulation under a number of the Clean Air Act's programs. After Massachusetts versus EPA, EPA adopted sort of a quartet of major rules between 2009 and 2011. One, they did issue an endangerment finding that greenhouse gas pollution from cars and light trucks particularly endangered health and welfare. They then adopted what's often called the vehicle rule, which imposed greenhouse gas standards for cars and trucks. Where this really started to get interesting was in the other two rules. One, some people call the timing rule. This just set up EPA's interpretation that once the regulation of cars and trucks of mobile sources actually took effect, that meant that greenhouse gases were regulated pollutants and that major sources of greenhouse gases, stationary sources of greenhouse gases, would have to go through these permitting programs, the PSD and Title V permitting programs. The fourth rule, the tailoring rule, essentially made sure that only the biggest sources of greenhouse gases would have to be covered, at least initially, under these permitting programs. There's a lot of detail around the tailoring rule, but essentially the statute imposes some pretty low mass-based thresholds on the amount of pollutants that would trigger inclusion in the permitting programs. And what EPA did was, using a variety of excuses for ignoring what the plain text of the statute says, and adjusted those thresholds upwards so that only the biggest of the greenhouse gases would be covered. The tailoring rule took effect in two steps. The one that's kind of most important for our purposes is the second step, which was to take effect on July 1st, 2011. And basically any new source of greenhouse gases, any brand new stationary facility that emits more than 100,000 tons of CO2 equivalent every year, or a source that modifies so as to increase its emissions by 75,000 tons a year, would have to go through PSD permitting, even if their emissions of other pollutants like nitrous oxide, particulate matter, the conventional pollutants, weren't big enough to actually trigger the PSD program. And this is where the biomass industry kind of freaked out, because a lot of biomass facilities, biomass-fired power plants, industrial facilities that burn a lot of biomass, have been able to stay out of the PSD program because they didn't emit enough conventional pollutants, or they were able to agree to sometimes bogus limitations on the amounts of pollutants, other pollutants they emit, so as to stay out of this federal regulation, to stay out of this federal permitting process. But once the tailoring rule went into effect, even medium small biomass facilities, like the equivalent of a 7 or 8 megawatt biomass plant, would easily exceed 100,000 tons of CO2 a year. I mean, we all know that when you burn wood, you get a lot of CO2. It's relatively inefficient. You've got to drive off the moisture. There's not a lot of energy content. So you get a lot of CO2 per unit of energy released when burning biomass. So the industry was very worried about having to go into this program. It's a much more stringent program than the state-level programs that a lot of these facilities were able to go through before the tailoring rule took effect. One very important thing to keep in mind is even if the greenhouse gas emissions were the only thing that brought a facility into the PSD program, they still would have to implement the best available control technology for the other pollutants that they emit, the pollutants that cause real direct impacts on health, such as nitrous oxides and particulate matter, which biomass tends to be pretty intensive on. So industry freaked out. They challenged the tailoring rule in court. That case has been put on the back burner. It's kind of been put on ice for now. And they also lobbied EPA hard to reconsider the applicability of the tailoring rule to biogenic carbon dioxide. EPA caved under the pressure. They granted reconsideration. And what we got out of that process was the exemption rule that we ultimately ended up challenging and defeating in court. So the exemption rule, it gets called the deferral rule because the exemption only lasts for 10 years, and EPA said they were just deferring the applicability of these permit programs to biogenic CO2. But it is, in effect, a permanent exemption for those facilities that or would have been a permanent exemption for those facilities that got permits during that three-year period, because they never would have had to go back through the process once the exemption expired. So what it did is it exempted biogenic CO2, essentially carbon dioxide from burning pretty much anything that's not a fossil fuel, everything from trees to tires, from being counted towards that 100,000-ton threshold that would put a facility into the permit program. It also exempted sources of biogenic CO2 from having to implement the best available control technology for their CO2 emissions for that same three-year period. And EPA's rationale was kind of interesting. They basically admitted without saying as much that the Clean Air Act, by its plain terms, required them to regulate biogenic CO2 just as it required them to regulate all other kinds of CO2. And rather than try to find some excuse in the Clean Air Act or some basis in the Clean Air Act for the exemption, they instead invoked a whole bunch of so-called excuse doctrines or justification doctrines for why they shouldn't have to follow what the law actually says. I won't go into the details of these. There are a number of these things are at issue in the tailoring rule as well. But essentially, the essential argument was that it would have been very, very difficult for EPA, because the science of biomass carbon accounting is so hard, it would have been very difficult for them to figure out, you know, what the net emissions from all these facilities are, and it would be a huge burden on permitting agencies. And so therefore, and it might also rope in, according to EPA, it might rope in some sources that don't have significant net emissions to the atmosphere, you know, so-called sources that really are clean in EPA's view. And so they would prefer not to regulate at all while they sort out the science. That was kind of their big pitch. And they convened a special panel of their scientific advisory board to kind of study the problem, with the thought that by July 2014, when the exemption expired, they would have a new rule in place, a new permanent rule in place to really deal with these issues. So a number of organizations challenged the exemption. The first challenge was filed in April 2011 by the Center for Biological Diversity, Conservation Law Foundation, Natural Resources Council of Maine. We challenged the grant, EPA's grant of reconsideration, which actually came out in January 2011. Then EPA finalized the exemption rule in July 2011, and that prompted another round of challenges. The same organizations, plus Georgia Forest Watch, Wild Virginia, Dogwood Alliance, Coastal Conservation League, and NRDC, filed challenges to the final exemption rule. All those cases got, there were about four different cases, and they all got consolidated together. Our basic arguments, we all had to collaborate on the briefs, and our basic arguments were that EPA had never identified any basis in the statute for the exemption, and that it also hadn't justified relying on these excuses that it came up with, that, you know, it was just going to be too difficult, or we might pull in sources that we shouldn't be regulating, et cetera. The case was fully briefed and argued by April 2013, and the decision came down on July 12th, 2013. And this kind of challenge, it doesn't start out in your regular trial court. It goes directly to the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals. So the challenge was heard before a panel of three judges, as appellate, you know, federal appellate cases generally are heard before three-judge panels. And as you sometimes see in very, very kind of politically charged contexts, we had three judges, and we got three separate opinions. There was a lead opinion that was joined by two of the judges, so there is an actual majority opinion that kind of announces the law, and then there was a dissenting opinion. The majority basically said that EPA didn't adequately justify its reliance on the excuses that it had advanced for not following the statute. It didn't really decide the statutory authority question. And left the door open for EPA to do another rulemaking, maybe even a permanent exemption of some kind, some limited scope, later on. But I think the decision put some important sideboards on EPA's ability to advance these excuses for not just following the law. There was a concurring opinion. One judge, Judge Kavanaugh, who's a very, very conservative judge, joined in the majority opinion, but also wrote his own opinion in which he said that he really, really strongly said that the Clean Air Act does not allow EPA to distinguish between biogenic carbon dioxide and fossil carbon dioxide. That it's a pollutant is a pollutant, and there's no basis in the law for making that distinction. Judge Henderson is also another conservative judge, dissented. Her basic view was that there haven't been that many sources permitted in reliance on the rule, there's not a really big deal, and that EPA should have been allowed to do what it wanted to do, which was basically to just not regulate anything while it figured out the science. So the majority opinion vacated the rule, essentially means invalidated the rule, sent it back to EPA. What happens next? I mean, we know a couple of things, but there are a lot of big questions about how this actually sort of comes to work in the world. One very important thing to point out is that the effect of the decision, what the Court of Appeal in legal terms calls the issuance of the mandate, is delayed for 45 days in case to give time for EPA or industry to ask the D.C. Circuit to rehear the case, either the panel or the whole D.C. Circuit to rehear the case. So the decision's technically not effective yet, and the mandate would issue, I think, on August 26th if nobody files a petition for rehearing. We don't know whether anyone's going to seek rehearing. It's very common for parties to seek rehearing. So the effective date of the decision actually could be pushed out a little bit longer if somebody does file a petition for rehearing. That could be EPA, it could be industry. If the decision holds up and becomes final, sources of more than 100,000 tons a year of biogenic CO2 will have to go through the PSD permitting process. They'll have to demonstrate best available control technology for greenhouse gases, and they'll have to demonstrate best available control technology for the other pollutants that they emit in significant amounts. And this is a big deal. I mean, some biomass facilities that are on a really tight budget might not want to go through the PSD permitting program because it's pretty expensive, at least according to industry. But even for the sources that do go through it, they'll have better emissions limits than would be imposed under most of the state-level permit programs that they had to go through before. There are some big questions. I mean, one question is to what the best available control technology for greenhouse gases looks like. I mean, unlike, you know, sulfur dioxide, which you can get out with a scrubber, or particulate matter, which you can put through a filter or baghouse or something like that, there currently isn't really widely available technology for capturing CO2 and doing something with it. EPA has come out with some really lousy guidance on this, specifically for biomass, where they've essentially said that burning biomass is the best available control technology for the greenhouse emissions produced by burning biomass. In other words, it's the best available control technology for itself. It's ridiculous. I mean, it's kind of an exemption by another name, and there are a lot of problems with it, but it really hasn't been relied on yet. I mean, one effect of this decision might be that more facilities are going to start relying on that kind of bogus rationale, and that's going to be something we'll have to keep an eye out for and look for possibility, you know, possible ways to push back against that. Another big question is what happens to the facilities that did get their permits in reliance on the exemption. The court didn't say anything about those permits specifically. But I think that there may be some avenues for challenging those permits, even where facilities have gotten them or have already started construction. That's one where I can't give, you know, direct legal advice. And if you're in that situation, you've got a plant you're worried about, I'd, you know, suggest that you consult a lawyer with a lot of experience in Clean Air Act permitting and try to figure out what your opportunities might be. Another big question is how EPA is going to respond to this. You know, the original idea of the exemption rule would be that they would adopt a new rule by July 2014, which would have been in effect. Up until the point of the decision, we hadn't seen any evidence that EPA was actually working on that rule. And my own sort of personal suspicion was that EPA probably would have just extended the exemption for a couple of years, you know, maybe to get it out past the 2014 elections, and if not the 2016 elections. EPA has a big habit under this administration of doing those kinds of one-off extensions, things like that. With this ruling, they no longer have that option. They can't just extend the exemption because it's invalid. So this may put some pressure on them, and industry is definitely putting some pressure on them to get to work on a new rule that would more permanently govern how EPA is going to deal with biogenic carbon dioxide emissions under these permitting programs. That's a wide open thing. EPA could go, you know, any way on it, but I think it's going to kickstart that process, and that's one that we'll all have to be watching very carefully, because I think it's going to
Do you want to take another 5 minutes and then open it up to questions?
I think maybe I've just got another 2 minutes if I can go. Just do that, and I'm sorry. I know I'm over my 15 minutes here, but
don't be sorry.
Just to finish up, I mean, the final big question is what happens to the tailoring rule. Again, this case involves an exemption from the overall scheme that was announced in the tailoring rule. The tailoring rule, of course, itself, along with the other all four rules that I talked about at the beginning of this, the quartet of EPA's rules, were challenged by industry. The D.C. Circuit upheld those rules in December last year. It refused rehearing by the whole court. And now all of those rules have essentially been appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court. There are petitions for the Supreme Court to take up those rules that are pending right now. And the Supreme Court hasn't yet decided whether it'll hear those rules. If the Supreme Court takes that case, and if the tailoring rule as a whole or any other major part of EPA's greenhouse gas regulation under the Clean Air Act is thrown out by the Supreme Court, it would, of course, kind of sweep away our victory as well, because our rule is just kind of an exemption from that overall effort to regulate greenhouse gases under the Clean Air Act. So that's another case that we'll have to keep our eyes on. I don't know when the Supreme Court's going to decide those petitions. It probably won't be until sometime this fall. So just to kind of wrap up, I do think this is a really significant ruling for our side. It puts the science of the impact of biomass on the climate front and center. It puts some real important sideboards around EPA's ability to just ignore the Clean Air Act in regulating greenhouse gas emissions. And it, at the very least, is going to get some of these facilities into a stronger permitting program that will result in a little bit better control of their emissions, not just greenhouse gases, but also the biomass emissions that really affect public health in neighboring communities. It also gives us a real opportunity to continue educating, to use the momentum of the victory to kind of push our message forward. And as always, you know, there's a flip side. We can expect an industry backlash. There's one going on right now. We're trying to, you know, figure out how to deal with. And again, it's too early to tell what the Supreme Court's going to do with the larger questions of regulation under the Clean Air Act. But so far, the D.C. Circuit has been very willing to uphold the regulation of greenhouse gases under the statute. In my view, that's very, very important. We don't have much time to act on climate change. Congress is not going to do it for us, and we've got some very powerful tools in hand, like the Clean Air Act, that we can use to try to deal with this problem. And I think we need to be moving a lot more aggressively than EPA has been moving in that direction, and these are all good signs coming out of the D.C. Circuit that authority exists and that EPA has a responsibility to use it. So apologize for talking for more than 15 minutes, and happy to entertain some questions.
Before we get into that, thank you so much, Kevin Bundy. Before we get into the question segment, if we could just please have those folks who came on after we started the call, if you could just announce your name and your state for the record. Just do this very quickly, please.
This is Ray Washington. I'm an attorney from Gainesville, Florida, home of the 100-megawatt biomass plant that's going to be tested this week.
Jim Travers from Albany, New York. I'm with the Citizens Environmental Coalition and other local organizations.
Do we have any other folks who came on the call? I know we do. I heard some dinging. Okay. Do we have anybody from the biomass industry on the call? No one who will admit it. Okay, well, let's go into the questions then. I think since we have a lot of folks on the call, the best way to do it might be by me taking stack. So those of you who want to ask questions, if you could just say your name right now, I'll put you on the list, and then I'll call on you one at a time to have some semblance of order.
Ray Washington.
Sammy Yasa.
Jim Travers. I don't know if you wanted me to say that again, but there you go.
Yeah, just say your name if you want to ask a question right now, and I'll put you on the list.
Chris Zinda.
Scott Hersing.
Chris Zinda, and who is the other person?
Scott Hersingen.
Nick Klappas.
Mike Ewall.
Why don't we cut it off at that right now, and if we have more time after, I'm not going to take up Kevin's entire day, but hopefully we can get through at least these and maybe a couple more. So, Ray Washington, if you want to go ahead and pose your question, please.
I do. It's possible this was answered, but I'm not sure that it was. The biomass plant that is about to go through its sinking and testing this week was permitted on the 30th of December 2010. It's being operated under a power purchase agreement with our local municipal utility. The executives of our local municipal utility are adamant that there is no way under any interpretation that this court ruling could affect in any way this plant. And I know that there's no answer. You've stated that, you know, there are too many unanswered questions, but this was not that kind of a statement. Their line is no way, no how. And I'm wondering if that is a statement that may be overly optimistic on their part.
So, yeah, I mean, without getting into it, I mean, I can't, you know, I don't know that the details of that permit, and I can't give you, you know, I mean, you're a lawyer too, right? So I mean, I'm the disclaimer, like, I can't give you legal advice about, you know, I'm not licensed to practice in Florida, whatever, and this, it shouldn't take this as legal advice, but my understanding of the way that all these rules work is that until the tailoring rule took effect, which first took effect on January 2nd, 2011, the greenhouse gases were not considered regulated pollutants or pollutants subject to regulation for purposes of these permitting programs. So there was a rush to get permits done by the end of 2010, and it sounds like your plant was among those that race to beat that deadline. And my understanding of the way that the overall scheme of greenhouse gas regulation operates would be that the facility probably doesn't have a requirement to do best available control technology for greenhouse gases, which would be the kind of the implication of the tailoring rule in that context. And that this ruling probably doesn't have that much bearing on the facility. Now, if the facility were to modify later on, if they were to change, you know, change their process or increase in size, I mean, God forbid, beyond 100 megawatts, in a way that increased those greenhouse gas emissions again by 75,000 tons a year. I mean, any change in the facility that resulted in another increase later on, then that would actually, after this ruling, trigger their responsibility to go back through the PSD program and to control those emissions. So,
Kevin, could you restate that for me? This is Chris in Lakeview. Thank you.
I think for facilities that were permitted before 2011, that got their permits before the tailoring rule took effect, this ruling probably doesn't have that much bearing on the validity of those permits or their responsibility under those permits. However, if those facilities in the future were to be modified or were to propose a modification that would result in an increase of greenhouse gas emissions, biogenic CO2, over 75,000 tons, let's say they add 4 or 5 megawatts of capacity, or change their process in a way that they increase their greenhouse gas emissions, then this ruling would have an effect, because they would have to go through the PSD permitting program because of that modification. I mean, again, it's important to keep in mind these permitting programs apply not just to brand new facilities, but also facilities that are modified in such a way that increases their emissions over the thresholds in the law that trigger applicability of the program. So looking backwards at those permits, my interpretation would be that there's probably not much of an effect of this ruling. Looking forward, if those facilities modify, there might be. Is that clear?
It is. Thank you.
Excellent. I believe the next question was, I didn't catch the name, but I think it was the individual from NRDC.
Thanks. It's Sammy Yassa, NRDC.
Sammy Yassa.
Kevin, thanks for all of your efforts on this. It's a really significant victory, and congratulations.
Well, and I want to give a lot of thanks to my co-plaintiff organizations and their lawyers as well, NRDC among them. So thank you.
I had a question about, you mentioned the EPA articulated a lot of excuses and rationales, many of them technical, for the exemption. Among them, that there might be good forms of biomass that would be unduly punished in the absence of an exemption and so forth. And I wanted to get an understanding of the court's opinion on the question of science. Did the court say that a pound of CO2 from a biogenic CO2 is the same as a pound of coal-generated CO2, and therefore no exemption is warranted? Or did they say that different forms of biomass will have different types of different degrees of carbon impact, and therefore a blanket exemption was unjustified and arbitrary and capricious?
Yeah, it's an excellent question. In some ways the court said both, and in some ways it said neither, and I'll try to explain that. The court did very clearly say that once a molecule of CO2 is in the atmosphere, the atmosphere can't tell whether it's from a biogenic source or a fossil source. I mean, CO2 is CO2. It exerts a warming influence on the atmosphere. It doesn't really matter. The majority opinion stopped short of saying, therefore, there's no basis in the Clean Air Act to distinguish between these sources. Judge Kavanaugh, in his concurring opinion, did actually say that. He said there's no basis in the Clean Air Act. But the majority opinion, Judge Tatel's decision for the majority, doesn't say that. In terms of the second part of your question, I think it is more along the lines that that the majority said that the problem with this exemption was that it was just overbroad. EPA didn't look at ways in which it might have tailored the exemption to sources that, in EPA's view, actually might have a good, carbon impact on the take CO2 out of the atmosphere, whatever, or not have a net increase of CO2 emissions, but actually just roped everything together in one sweeping exemption for all biogenic CO2, and that's what EPA really failed to justify. They didn't consider kind of more narrow alternatives, nor did they explain how they were actually going to be moving towards regulating biogenic CO2 by just exempting everything all at once. There was a little bit of a wrinkle in all this. When EPA first issued its rule, it relied on this or seemed to rely on this idea that there are at least some kinds of biomass out there that have de minimis or even positive impacts on the climate. De minimis meaning, negligible, like it's basically, the CO2 comes out in a wash. And EPA's view was that it really wouldn't make any sense to force those facilities to go through the permitting program. But when EPA got to court, when they got to the litigation in their brief, they disavowed that theory. They said, "Oh no, we never meant to rely on that. That's just the kind of thing that we would invoke in a permanent exemption." It was a very puzzling decision on their part, but I think the upshot is that it leaves EPA open, and the court's decision leaves EPA a window to advance that kind of theory later. Essentially, to say we're going to do an exemption for, you know, X, Y, and Z categories of sources that we feel are either negligible or they're having a positive impact on the climate. And the examples that came out in the rulemaking were things like landfill gas collection. There were things like wastewater treatment plants that generate material that could be burned on site or put in a digester. Things that the proponents might argue reduce methane emissions by burning methane and turning it into CO2, that kind of thing. I think where they'll have a hard time with that de minimis argument is in the forest context, where you're actually cutting living trees. I mean, no matter what your reasons for cutting them down, then they're going to have a harder time with the idea that the woody biomass, I think, has a de minimis effect. So again, I mean, we'll see what EPA does with it, but it is more along the lines that EPA thinks there might be good sources and bad sources, and they might have a window, even under the majority opinion at least, to make some kind of distinction. How they explain that, how they justify it under the Clean Air Act, whether they can justify it, that all remains to be seen and fought out. Does that answer your question to some extent?
Yes, it nailed it exactly. The follow-up question is, did the court actually have an opinion on the science itself, or did they just presume there's de minimis and non-de minimis?
The court didn't actually rule on that, and I mean, I think that the court's opinion is very strongly influenced by the science. You know, you can see a recognition in the court's opinion that the net CO2 impact on the atmosphere may differ among, you know, feedstocks or among sources of biomass. It may be worse for some, not as bad for others. But in terms of actually evaluating the science, taking a position on what the science says about how you do that carbon accounting, the court did not go there. And I'd be very, very surprised if the court did. I mean, one thing about the D.C. Circuit especially, but with courts in general with respect to this kind of legal challenge, is that they like to leave the details of the science to the agency to work out. It's very rare that they will explicitly, you know, substitute their own scientific judgment for the judgment of an agency. And I think what the court recognized here is that there wasn't any science in EPA's exemption. They just, you know, rolled everything together. They didn't even really attempt to say anything about the science other than, oh, gee, it's complicated, it's expensive, it's burdensome, we don't want to do it. And that, I think, is what the court was saying EPA couldn't get away with. As far as endorsing one particular scientific perspective on this over another, I think the majority opinion actually was very careful not to do that.
Excellent. If we could have Jim Travers ask your question now, please.
Well, this is going to affect all sources, but I'm concerned now, too, about tire burning in certain biomass, because I come at this from an MSW aspect. And now EPA has designated refuse tires as a fuel and not needing to be permitted. So that's of deep concern, too. I mean, this is a great decision, but what's really spectacular about it is that it reinforced the Clean Air Act, the justification for this as being the Clean Air Act, enforcing it, and it's long, long overdue. So I thank you for your good work. Really, I guess I don't have a question right now, just a comment, but thank you.
Well, thank you. And I mean, I think you bring up a really good point. This is not the only recent EPA rule that has some bearing on biomass. And I think you advert to the redefinition of solid waste as fuel. And these are areas of the act that I don't know quite as well, but have to do with the with the regulation of solid waste incinerators and the regulation of hazardous air pollutants, like really, really super toxic air pollutants under the Clean Air Act. And there was a bunch of rules, and I know these have been discussed on the email list, that that contain some pretty big, if not total, exemptions, some relaxation of the requirements for biomass. We're dealing with a very, very powerful industry here. I mean, it's kind of weird in some ways how powerful it is, but I think it's the ties to the timber and the paper industries and some very influential senators that have, you know, put a lot of weight behind this. But yeah, I mean, this is the greenhouse gas emissions are just one aspect of the problem with biomass, and they're just one aspect of the I think the influence that industry tries to exert here. So
yeah, we're fighting.
So
two,
yeah, you're absolutely correct.
Sorry, we're fighting two local plants as well as I work on cement kiln issues, and we're involved in suing the EPA right now on arbitrary regulation delays. Yeah.
Well, thank you for your work. I appreciate it.
So thank
great.
You.
Great. Thank you, Jim. If we could have Chris Zinda, you got your question ready?
Okay. I'm not certain I have a lot of question other than just a comment in a way. Oregon's kind of heated up recently in many different facets. Seneca out of Springfield is going to soon be requesting a modified air containment discharge permit here in Lakeview. We currently have an air containment discharge permit on the street for modification. Seneca's built, Lakeview's not. And they're currently going through modified permitting, and that's why I asked you to restate what you had said earlier in regard to applicability of this decision. We were permitted in September 2009 or 2010, but these modified permits are underway. But I suspect our air containment discharge permit will be issued at the probably the end of September, which will probably be far too late or too soon in a way. To be affected by the decision. But part of our case deals with EPA's changes with condensables versus filterables. And I'm kind of wondering whether or not CO2 and condensables have a role together to play. So do you control the controls for CO2, do they include controlling the condensables from an emission source that can, in our case in Lakeview, it's three times the amount of emissions from their original permit.
In terms of condensable particulate matter?
That's correct, yeah. So PM2.5, condensables, CO2, those things. And I'm not a scientist, so I don't know whether CO2 it can be controlled through the control of condensables, you see.
No.
Yeah, I I'm not a scientist either, and
okay.
I hesitate to answer that question at all.
Oh,
really,
exactly.
I mean, I think that's a great question for an air expert, for an engineer.
Okay.
I mean, my understanding is that you know, when you're talking about controlling CO2, that there isn't really a lot you can do to the combustion process to get less CO2 out of it. And in some ways, the kinds of efficiency improvements that you make to reduce the emissions of other pollutants by controlling combustion so that the combustion is more efficient actually produce more CO2 while they reduce other pollutants. I don't know what the relationship between CO2 and the condensable fraction of PM2.5 is. You know, yeah, good question for an engineer,
good.
And I'm sorry. I can't.
However, I don't think that there's much the decision is going to do to affect our current permitting stage.
Not unless those modifications are going to bump up the biogenic CO2 emissions by more than 75,000 tons a year, which could then send the facilities into PSD permitting instead of the Oregon, you know, whatever process Oregon has for minor sources.
Okay, so then my last question is, given the importance of Mr. Wyden on the Senate Energy and Natural Resources Committee and Mr. DeFazio's current minority chair of the House Resources Committee, and everything that's going on here in Oregon, and you mentioning earlier the powerful proponents for the tailoring rule and the exemption, is there anything that we can do here in Oregon to help lobby or provide pressure?
Yeah, if you can change Ron Wyden's mind on this, that would be fabulous. I don't know how realistic that is, but he's very influential on these matters, and you know, in the Western U.S., as you know, I mean, I know there are folks from all over the country on this call. In the Western U.S., biomass issues are wound up super, super, super tight with ideas about wildland fire, about the need to get in there and, you know, and thin and do something with all this small diameter wood that's, you know, going to cause catastrophic wildfire and things like that. I mean, there's a land management, forest management, fire ecology, fire fear issue that is just bound very, very tightly with the biomass industry in the Western U.S. And you see this from folks like Wyden, from folks like Max Baucus. It's a tough nut to crack out here, I think, because of those very emotional fire-related issues that are wound up with it. I don't know the particulars of the plants you're talking about. I don't know to what extent they're relying on that rationale or, you know, fuels
they're
from thinning treatments.
They're 100% relying on that rationale. They're 100% relying on that rationale, yep.
So I think that's the big in some ways that's the big political challenge in the Western states and with some of those very influential senators is to really kind of start looking beyond that and behind that rationale and challenging it. And it's a very tough one, but yeah, I mean it's you know, of course, I mean you've got one of the most influential folks on this issue as your senator, and anything you can be doing with his office, I think, is of benefit.
Well, to that end, I was on a call yesterday with a reporter who's been doing a piece on biomass for the last 6 months, and he had suggested that he had did a FOIA request for the EPA for all correspondence between the Oregon Congressional Delegation and EPA on the issue of the tailoring rule pre and post 2011. And they've been delaying. They've delayed him for 6 months, and they're continuing.
I'm still waiting on the FOIA request I filed back in 3 years ago on this issue.
Yeah,
you know? I mean, yeah, they will delay. They'll string it out. You know,
okay,
how they. Yeah. So.
Great. Well, thanks, Chris, for your questions and comments on that. We got three more folks in line here. We're hoping we can get to before the end of the call. The next person in
would
line.
Would you add somebody to that line, Diane Devi?
Sure. If we have time, I'll put you on the reserve list here, Diane. The other person, Scott, sorry, is your last name Hersenen?
Yeah, Hersena. We're fighting the construction of a tire-burning facility, and it was permitted in October of 2011. Now, they did go through the PSD process, and they did submit a BACT for the greenhouse gases. But part of that submission includes an assumption of a 20% biomass fraction for the tires. And I guess my question is, would there be any way to go back to the EPA and ask them to reexamine this without the 20% biomass fractions?
You know, I'm not sure
yeah.
I can answer that. I don't know enough about the tire burning to say what a reasonable fraction. I mean, do you feel like that's too high or too low, or how did that
well,
play out?
Well, okay. The consideration of the since they're no longer going to be considering the biogenic CO2. That would bump up the CO2 from 682,000 tons over 800,000 tons, which is
right.
A significant increase. So I didn't know if there was any reason to believe we could go back to the EPA to, you know, request them to review this since under the new ruling here.
But they had to go through PSD anyway because if I understand correctly, the non-biogenic CO2
right.
was already
over the... Right, yeah, they went
through
the PSD because
yeah.
of all the other emissions, and they did do the BACT on that, so...
Yeah, I mean, again, I don't know the specifics of the permit and can't advise you one way or another. I mean, I'd say you should talk to somebody local who's got a handle on this stuff for sure, but I'm not thinking of anything right off the top that seems like a really good way to revisit that. I mean, if they went through PSD already and they did do some kind of back for the greenhouse gases, I mean, those are really the things that the that our court victory would give us where they didn't otherwise apply.
Right.
So,
right.
I mean, if they already did that, it's, you know, I'm not, yeah, just right off the top, I'm not seeing much of a, you know, much avenue for that. But, you know, again, I mean, you should talk to somebody who can really sit down with those permit documents and tell you for sure before you take my word for it.
Okay, thank you.
Great. Thank you, Scott. Next question from Nick. And again, I don't have the last name. Is it Lavis?
It's Lavis. Nick Lavis from Californians Against Waste.
Excellent. Please go ahead.
Oh, hi, Nick. All right.
Hey, how's it going? My question was, I think, partially answered in response to the gentleman from NRDC. But I'm wondering about the impact of this decision on composting facilities, which, by virtue of nature, basically break down material into CO2, and I think above the thresholds that we're talking about. Do you have any sense of what that could look like?
Oh, you know, I don't. I'm not I'm not familiar. I've never looked at a compost facility permit, air permit specifically. I don't really know how those issues are handled. I mean, I guess that there is a possibility that if you had a pretty good-sized compost facility, and again, you would know better than I how big of a facility you'd need to generate 100,000 tons a year of CO2, I guess that this might pull those facilities into the PSD program in a way that perhaps they wouldn't have otherwise because they don't emit enough, VOCs or anything like that. But again, I don't know to what extent those kind of non-stack emissions are regulated. I've never really looked at it.
Kevin, this is Mary. I can jump in here for a second.
Yeah, if you wouldn't mind, that'd be great.
If you consider that a 7-megawatt facility burning all the carbon that's given to it is going to emit around 100,000 tons, and so the general rule of thumb is about 12,500 tons of green wood per megawatt. So a 7-megawatt facility would be burning around 87,000 tons of wood and completely combusting that to CO2 a year. I really doubt that a composting facility would be anywhere near that because that's the total liquidation of all the carbon in the fuel.
Can you just step back for 1 second on the math there? What tonnage did you think for a biomass facility?
Well, a 7-megawatt facility, the rule of thumb is 12,500 tons per megawatt of capacity per year.
And so that gives us a total of 87,000 tons. So, I mean, we have composting facilities in the 300,000-ton-a-year range, and they release about half of their...
Oh, really?
Yeah,
that's,
I would assume
that's
so.
That's impressive. Well, and if they're counting methane too, then you might actually be, but I doubt that this would mean very much in terms of PSD for, I mean, what, you know, I like Kevin, I have no idea what PSD would look like for a facility like that.
Right.
It's certainly not going to be a big expensive process that's going to slow down a project like that like it would be for, at least I hope it wouldn't be, but.
Kevin, do we have time for a few more questions?
Yeah, Nick, it's a great question. Maybe we can follow up on that and give it some more thought. So, yeah.
Kevin, I think it's time for another lunch.
All right, sounds good.
Do you have time for two more questions, Kevin?
I joined the call late. Just wanted to say I am participating.
Oh, great. Thank you for making it on the call. We are approaching 4 o'clock, but Kevin, do you have time for a couple more questions?
Yeah, I can hang out a little bit later.
Okay, I appreciate that. So the next one we have is from Mike Ewall.
Okay, hello. So I have a few questions. Hi, how are you doing? So my first one, I guess the biggest one, is what do you think they're going to cook up next in order to try to exempt biomass? So I saw some language in at least one of the press releases about it indicating that one of the judges thought that there was some simpler way of doing this, and it sounded like they had other things in mind. And I'll just ask my other two questions quickly as well. Particularly because of the redefinition of solid waste as fuel, we're seeing a lot of pelletizing trash and turning into fuel that can be marketed to every coal boiler or any kind of boiler. And I'm wondering if any boilers that switch fuels would trigger having to go through like a reexamination of PSD in this case. Mm-hmm. And my third question is on if you happen to know any more specifics about landfill gas to energy and how this ruling would impact that.
Yeah, great questions. I'll do what I can. In terms of what's next, I mean, I have no idea what EPA is going to come up with. I mean, yeah, the judges did leave the door open to EPA being able to do pretty, you know, any number of things, especially on this theory that there are some biomass sources that are quote unquote de minimis that don't have, you know, much of a net emission to the atmosphere. The EPA has. At least they kind of started out during the early part of the exemption rule that looked like they were moving towards some kind of overall framework for accounting for biomass emissions. And I think some folks on this call may be familiar with that. The EPA actually proposed a draft framework for accounting for biogenic CO2. They ran it by their scientific advisory board panel, and it got pretty much roundly panned. It was heavily criticized, and the panel sort of confirmed that that there really aren't very many shortcuts to doing this work. You've really got to do a credible analysis based on the kind of biomass feedstock you're talking about, the kind of facility you're talking, you know, the kind of facility you're talking about, combusting it or converting it. And there are going to be a number of different pathways and baselines and you know, more or less complicated calculations that go into it. So it seems like it would be scientifically very difficult for EPA to come back with another very broad blanket exemption for biomass. That said, the industry has a lot of very, you know, simplistic but glossy looking, you know, reports on how you know, all biogenic carbon is just part of the natural carbon cycle. It goes up, it comes down. We shouldn't worry about it. It doesn't have any effect on the climate. I suppose it's possible EPA could go with a rationale like that, but I think that would be a pretty huge, it'd be a pretty big risk on their part. I think it's more likely that they'll try to do something that at least looks a little bit more nuanced, but still tries to, you know, in effect exempt as much of the industry as they can. Your fuel switching question, the facility that I'm imagining is like a coal or pet coke facility that starts co-firing with biomass. I think before our victory, when they just weren't counting CO2, those facilities could make the argument that by substituting, you know, 10 or 20% biomass for their coal, they were actually reducing their CO2 emissions by that amount. I mean, of course, that was just because they weren't counting the CO2 emissions from the biomass. Because biomass actually produces more CO2 per unit of energy produced than burning coal, you could end up in a situation now where that co-firing or substituting biomass for some portion of that coal actually increases CO2 emissions. And if it increased CO2 emissions above that, you know, 75,000 ton modification threshold, then I guess you might have to go back through PSD for that modification. And again, that's sort of one hypothetical situation. I'm not sure if that really gets at what you're talking about. On landfill gas, you know, again, that's an area that I just don't know that much about. You know, the technology involves collecting methane and you know, converting it to CO2 through combustion. And again, I think it's going to depend on how big those facilities are and how much CO2 they produce. But I could see some of those having to go through PSD that didn't have to before.
Okay, thank you.
Great. Thanks for that. One last question we have from Diane Deavy.
Yes, thank you.
Can people mute if you're not speaking?
I can't hear.
Yeah, we've got a lot of interference in the background of folks.
Yeah, somebody's got a TV on or something.
Is there any way?
You just press *6 and you would mute yourself. Thank you. Go ahead, Diane.
Yeah, okay. No, this concerns the longevity of PSD permits that were awarded prior to 2011. I understand that the Title V requirement, and I could be an error on this, I'm asking you, doesn't Title V allow or require a review every 5 years of PSDs to see whether they are consistent with contemporary regulations?
It's a great question, and I can't give you a 100% confident answer. You're right. Title V permits are reviewed every 5 years. My understanding is that that the Title V permit itself, though, doesn't require a facility to come into compliance with, you know, changes in the law that might have occurred in the interim. So I don't know that the Title V renewal alone would offer you an opportunity to go and reopen a PSD permit. Again, this is something to talk to an attorney who can have access to the facility, you know, the permit documents for the facility that you care about, and really get a good read on that. So I don't want to, you know, hesitate to give you too definitive an answer. But my understanding of the PSD program is that it really just applies to pre-construction. It applies pre-construction, whether it's new construction or modification, and that once it's in place, unless there's a subsequent modification, those emissions limits will continue to control, and then will be carried forward in the subsequent Title V permits. You know, unless there's a modification, then that's particular to PSD. There may be other Clean Air Act requirements that get updated in the meantime that then the Title V permit would have to reflect, you know, with hazardous air pollutants, new source performance standards, that kind of thing.
Yeah. Okay.
So
thank
I don't
you.
Know. I hope I'm not totally wrong on that. That's a little outside my experience, and maybe somebody else on the call has a better answer. I don't know.
If I may, this is Jim Travers. I just went through this with the cement plant, and yes, they have they'll modify the permit.
They what?
They'll modify the permit for the increase.
Oh, for an increase. But if there's no increase, then a five-year review will not do anything to it, right?
No, I don't think so. Unless.
Okay, thank you.
Great. Yeah, thank
well,
you.
Well, I think that'll have to do it. We're five over. Thanks again to our excellent guest speaker, Kevin Bundy, Senior Attorney for Center for Biological Diversity, and thanks to everyone who made that on the call. And just for a future announcement, we have these National Anti-Biomass Incineration Campaign calls the first Thursday of every month. The next call is September 5th. We're going to have a medical doctor discussing some of the health impacts from biomass incineration. If you want to have notice of these future calls, or if you want the link to this current call and or the notes, you can email me, Josh Schlossberg, at josh@energyjustice.net. Thanks again. Everyone, take care.
Thank you.
Yes, wonderful.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Great job. Thank you all.
Thank you.
It's a lot.